Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 4th of May. Interesting hour coming up. Michael Lewis will join us in just a few moments. He is the author of the number one New York Times, obviously bestseller, The Big Short, Inside the Doomsday Machine. He is considered one of, if not the greatest financial journalist in the country. And this story is interesting. If you don't understand derivatives very well and all that's been going on and why Wall Street crashed in 2008, you'll get the nitty-gritty on that, but also a really great read because some of the characters involved in this are quite something and people that you haven't heard much about. Michael wrote his first bestseller, Liar's Poker, about his experiences as a young Wall Street bond trader when he was in his 20s. He's known as a one-time wonder boy on Wall Street, even though he says he didn't know what the heck he was doing. He didn't have a clue. He's written seven more bestsellers, including Liar's Poker, Moneyball, The Blind Side, and also Home Game. And the book looks at how some of Wall Street's finest minds, and actually some of the minds are people who had a conscience, how they managed to destroy $1.75 trillion of wealth in the subprime mortgage markets. He says that he's afraid that our culture will come to the conclusion, because it's always the easiest conclusion, that everybody was just a bunch of criminals. I think the story is much more interesting than that. I think it is a story of mass delusion. So what he did was he discovered little-known facts and some extremely interesting characters that changed people's perception about a story. He sat down to write, and the story is not about Hank Paulson or Ben Bernanke or the CEOs of Wall Street. It's about different people in different firms, and they're interesting people to read about, very smart people, and he's going to join us right now to talk about that. Coming up the second half hour of our program today, we'll be speaking with Mike Allen, who was featured in the New York Times Magazine section, long piece about Politico and his playbook, which now I'm reading every morning. You know, you get kind of hooked on it. Oh, all this news. So that's coming up the second half hour. Oh, our phone lines are almost all filled for Michael Lewis. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Hello, Michael. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, great to have you on. Where in the world did you find these people? I mean, you could have none of the financial information and just write stories about these very, very interesting and kind of eccentric characters.
If I didn't have the characters, I don't think I would have written the book. You know, it's funny because though the financial crisis is obviously a big story, what really engaged me was that these people were so curious, the people who were right about the crisis. And how I found them, it wasn't that hard because there weren't that many people who were on the right side of the financial system in 2007. The subprime mortgage bond market unraveled and the stock market unraveled with it. And these were people who would, anybody who had a big bet against the subprime mortgage bond market did really, really well in that period. And they were kind of well, you know, on the street, they were well known. And so it was more that the difficult part was getting them to sort of let me move into their lives.
Right. Tell us about, they're all fascinating, but tell us about the guy who had the glass eye, who was a doctor, who wrote this blog. And what's interesting to me is so many people on Wall Street were reading what his blog was, and overnight he becomes a millionaire because they're all going to give him money.
Yes. Well, his name is Michael Burry, and he was a neurologist at the Stanford University Hospital. He was in residency there. And he really, he was a young doctor who didn't really want to be a doctor. And he spent, believe it or not, he thought he had free time during his residency. And this is in the late 90s, and he starts writing a blog about value investing, essentially what Warren Buffett does, looking for cheap, undervalued companies to invest in. And as he does this, he realizes that he's being followed increasingly by Wall Street pros, the people that come in. The people who are coming to his blog are people from big Wall Street firms. And so one day he up and announces he's going to quit being a doctor and he's going to become a hedge fund manager. manager, even though he has no money. He has $145,000 in student loans to pay off, and that's kind of it. And money comes out of the woodwork. I mean, a company that's owned by Warren Buffett gives him $5 million. Another big New York investor gives him $5 million, and he's off and running. But what's curious about him? I mean, there are lots of things that are curious about him. But he, this is a person who thought he was put on this earth to find, to make productive investments in cheap companies, to find value in the stock market. And after he does this very, very well for several years, and has an incredible track record. He's soon running about $600 million. And it's at this point he discovers that he can't really invest in the stock market without understanding this weird thing called the subprime mortgage bond market. Mm-hmm. And he starts to kind of dig into it. He realizes that essentially a house of cards is being built, and he can no longer do what he really thought he should be doing, and instead gets twisted into this very weird gamble against the subprime market. As a character, he was so wonderful because he has Asperger's syndrome and doesn't know it. He was not diagnosed until quite late in my story, but he has this social problem. He doesn't interact with people. He doesn't want to interact with people, and so all of his decisions are very data-based. He's reading financial documents that most people aren't reading, and so he tells you, you know, that was one way to get to the right answer in 2005 and 2006, is not listen to what people were saying.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing to me how many of these people that you outlined really did a lot of digging to find out what all these areas were, what the subprime mortgage bond market was, what derivatives were, what was going on with the shady lending going on for subprime mortgages. There wasn't a whole lot known, and so you've got a handful of characters who are learning what's going on when everybody should have known what was going on.
That's one of the things that's really striking about this period in Wall Street, is that the people who made the smart bet were outsiders to this market.
Right.
They had no understanding what the ratings agencies did. They didn't know what a subprime mortgage bond was when they get into this, and so that they're asking questions with very fresh eyes. And from a narrative point of view, this is very useful because they're learning. The reader can learn with them. But from a life point of view, it's interesting because you would have thought that the people who would be most cynical about this, about the subprime mortgage bond market, and about essentially the corruption in the bond market that had occurred, would be people deep on the inside, and that they would be the most prepared to see it for what it was. But that turned out not to be true.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that some of them were sort of like you when you didn't know what you were doing on Wall Street, and you obviously had to do some studying because you were considered to be a wonder boy?
Wonder Boy might be putting it too strong, but you know, I spent 3 years at Solomon Brothers in the late '80s, and I did okay. It didn't hurt me that I came with very little in the way of assumptions, and that I had to kind of learn it all when I got there. Because, I tell you what didn't hurt me. That's putting it the wrong way. Putting it the right way is that I wasn't really afraid to ask stupid questions. Because I didn't think I was stupid, and these people were the same way. They were pretty intellectually self-confident,
right,
and so they didn't mind asking, like Moody's and Standard & Poor's, how on earth do you take this pile of junk and call it AAA rated? And that's something that, you know, to put the question that bluntly seems very obvious now, but mm-hmm. It was not very obvious in 2005.
Very few people were asking that question, weren't they? Which is pretty remarkable.
Yes. The flip side of your observation that these people who I write about were all kind of oddballs and weirdos and marginal characters, and but these were the people who got it right, these were the smart people. The flip side of that is that, you know, all the normal people got it wrong. The people at the center of the system got it wrong. And sort of, so why was that? Why was it that the obvious insights were lacking in the middle of the financial system? I think there's probably a large part of the American public that thinks it's as simple as, oh, they're just a bunch of criminals who are lying all the time. But the fact remains that these firms, these big Wall Street firms, ended ended up taking huge losses because they may have been lying about what they were selling, but in many cases they believed their own lies. It really was, you know, I think this story is a story as much about human perception as it is anything else. That given a set of facts, if you, you know, you pay people to misinterpret the facts, they will actually honestly misinterpret the facts.
Right. Oh, my gosh. Tell us about the guy who voted Republican. He considered himself a Republican, and he winds up perhaps being one of the few, I don't know, maybe there are more now, socialists on Wall Street.
Huh. I don't know how many socialists on Wall Street there are, but this is Steve Eisman. And Steve Eisman is another made-to-order literary character because he does start his life on Wall Street in his as a pretty right-wing Republican. And he stumbles in kind of accidentally. He's a Harvard Law School graduate who hates being a lawyer, and his mom and dad get him a job at their own little brokerage firm, and which is humiliating for him because he's been a big success in life up to that point. And he comes into Wall Street in the early mid-90s when the subprime mortgage bond market was just being created, and the subprime lending market was just getting up and running. And his job, he was the one of the first two analysts of subprime lenders. And so he watches this on-the-ground interaction between high finance and lower middle and middle-class America, and he becomes more and more cynical about it. He didn't believe that, you know, you could actually make a good living as a corporation designing products to rip people off. And he becomes convinced that essentially consumer lending is a game about of exploiting the poor and the uninformed. And so with this insight comes political change. He drifts in his mid-late 30s and early 40s. He drifts from being a right-wing Republican to being very left-wing. I mean, not quite a socialist, but close. And he does this while making a fortune on Wall Street. But he was positioned, Eisman was a wonderful character because he too was a social misfit. His peculiarity was a real talent for insulting people. I mean, that
he was a rude guy. Mm-hmm.
His own wife says, "My husband's rude. I've tried and I've tried and I've tried. Nothing I do changes him." But he was perfect for this period because what he really liked to do was insult important people. So he'd wander into these Wall Street meetings where some poobah from a Wall Street firm was, and it instantly started telling him he was an idiot. This did not make him popular on Wall Street.
I'm sure. We're going to welcome a couple phone calls for you in just a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. Michael Lewis is our guest. His latest book is The Big Short. You know that. Inside the Doomsday Machine. He's the author of a lot of bestsellers. Liar's Poker, Moneyball, The Blind Side, and Home Game. And we'll be with you in just a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Mike Allen featured in the New York Times in a big story a couple weeks ago in their magazine section from Playbook will be joining us. A longtime writer also for Time magazine and the Washington Post. And now he has become the man that the White House wakes up to every morning. More on that in just a moment. And let's go to phone calls for Michael. Our first caller is Rick from Milwaukee. Hello, Rick.
Good morning to you and your guest, Mr. Lewis. I located your book. I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but I heard something on early morning radio from the Wall Street Journal, and that is 13 members of the United States Congress have personally benefited from short selling as the American economy tanked, and a lot of them kind of distanced themselves from this by having their wives or their stockbrokers do it for them. But I mean, as members of Congress are benefiting from the tanking of the economy, isn't that a basic conflict of interest for the American people?
Well, I guess in the first place, it's kind of surprising that the Wall Street Journal is highlighting the intelligence of members of Congress. Who would have thought that members of Congress would have the prescience to bet against the American economy? I don't know I don't actually know the details of this. I think that it's you'd have to see the details. Is it a conflict of interest for members of Congress to have any sort of position in the financial markets if they're going to benefit one way or another from them? I guess very broadly, I think it would be very hard to prevent them from doing so. I suppose it's a little more obnoxious, the idea that they are benefiting from things going down as opposed to things going up. But either way, it raises the possibility there's some sort of conflict.
Thanks, Rick, for the call. Linda from Monroe. Hi, Linda.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi.
Good morning, Mr. Lewis. We're presently reading your book. It's The Big Short, and it's an awesome read. It's a pleasure to talk with you. Now, I feel if every elected official would have been reading your books that you've written over the years, there wouldn't have been any need for a government bailout of free enterprise. And I'm not so sure if they don't put some real regulations on them that we could have another bailout. Now, I understand that the worldwide derivative market is about $600 trillion, and it's growing, and it's still out of control, and it's virtually worthless or counterfeit money. Now, what would you suggest our government officials do to get the derivative market under control?
It's a really good question, and there are several broad answers to it. I mean, and how it finds its way into legislation is still unclear. But I'm heartened right now by the discussion in Washington. I think that they've gotten quite serious about regulating Wall Street properly. Number one, one of the big problems in the financial system is not the presence of derivatives. Derivatives can be used usefully. It's the way they're traded. If the trader at Goldman Sachs can dial up the trader at Morgan Stanley and make a $10 billion side bet that nobody knows about. And they did. I mean, there's stories in the Big Short where the trader at Morgan Stanley loses almost $10 billion from a handful of side bets he makes with three or four of the Wall Street firms. And nobody knows about these side bets. They're not, they're registered maybe on Morgan Stanley's balance sheet under a line item, derivatives, where it says derivatives $3 trillion, but no one knows what's in there. And so the problem with this is that when the trading is opaque, when it's behind closed doors, kind of bilaterally like that, you don't know who's got what risk. And so when one firm gets in trouble, essentially everybody's in trouble. They're getting this death grip because you don't know who's exposed to that one firm. And that's partly what happened when Lehman Brothers failed in September of 2008. That all the other firms, their existence was thrown into doubt, because nobody knew who was exposed to Lehman Brothers. And so the way you fix that is you ban that sort of bilateral trading. You say if you're going to trade these things, whatever kind of derivatives they are, you have to do it on exchanges or through clearinghouses where a regulator can see who's got what exposures. And the exposure isn't to each other, it's to this third party. So they don't threaten each other's existence when one of them gets into trouble. The other thing is, and this is, the derivatives market is, in its most abstruse, is unbelievably complicated.
Mm-hmm.
We tried to sit here and explain it to your audience, their eyes would glaze over. And this is a huge advantage for Wall Street firms. The complexity is used to exploit the customers, and that new stuff gets dreamed up, and the Wall Street firms make a whole bunch of money from the customers, basically ignorance of what the new stuff is. And so I think that the so-called Volcker rule gets at this, and it's the rule that says you, the big Wall Street firm that's dreaming up this stuff, can't make bets for your own self in the same stuff you're trying to peddle to your customers. I mean, Goldman Sachs is now in all sorts of trouble because this is what they were doing. This is what a number of them were doing, dreaming up complicated derivative products that were designed to fail so they could bet against them for their own account at the expense of their customer. And so if you eliminated that conflict, you'd go some way towards introducing some sanity into this market.
You talk, Michael, about people come to the conclusion that everybody was just a bunch of criminals, maybe because it's so complex that it's hard for us to see all the machinations here. You say that you think this story is much more interesting than that. It's a story of mass delusion. But the book is also filled with some stories of what seems to me to be criminal behavior, particularly in the housing market, where people are, you know, are thinking that they can have their American dream, their houses, and the rates that they're paying, the interest rates are fluctuating, and they're sold a bill of goods. There were a lot of people who were, it seems to me, acting criminally.
Well, God knows, it's hard to know what was criminal, what was not, but it's not hard to know what was wrong, what was right.
Right.
And yes, there was an awful lot of deceit in the market, and it was deceit on the ground. The relationship between the subprime lender and the subprime borrower was riven with deceit on both sides. That in some cases you had the subprime lender deceiving the borrower about the loans, the nature of the loan he was taking on. And in a lot of cases, you had the borrowers lying about their incomes or whether they intended to live in the house they were buying, and so on and so forth. So it was massive deceit in the market. The problem is that it went all the way up the chain, the food chain, to the very top. So there was a massive deceit being practiced by the big Wall Street firms upon investors and with the help of the ratings agents. So it all in the service of essentially disguising the risk of these loans so that they could be made, because in the making of them, everybody made a lot of money.
Right.
So there was bad behavior. There's no question there's bad behavior. Again, I don't know how much of it actually is criminal, but it was a lot of bad behavior. The point I was making is that it's not as simple as just bad behavior, that you have case after case of Wall Street trader who you might otherwise think was a kind of bad actor, who is essentially practicing deceit, but who believed his own lies, who ended up losing billions of dollars because he believed the stuff he was saying that wasn't true. And I think really that at the bottom of this story, when you want to think about, and especially when you want to think about how you fix Wall Street, is a story of really misaligned incentives, of people having really incentives not to think clearly about what they're doing, and it's the incentives that need to be fixed. If you just go after criminal misconduct and throw a few people in jail and leave the incentives intact, we're going to have this same problem all over again.
And they're not thinking clearly because of the gold at the end of the rainbow, or why?
The big problem in the financial system is that everybody's interest is very short term. That the Wall Street CEO is put in this very weird position because his company is a public corporation, that he's measured ruthlessly on his performance every quarter. So if some business comes along that seems temporarily very profitable, like underwriting lots of subprime mortgage loans, he can't afford not to be in it, even if it's a long term disaster, because all his competitors will be in it, and his firm will be less profitable, and his shareholders will be angry at him and get thrown out of his job. So, on the level of the individual Wall Street trader, he's getting paid huge sums of money at the end of the year based on the profits on his books in that year. He lives year to year, and he's not thinking much beyond that. Mm. If things don't go well for him in his firm, he can always go to another firm.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a kind of a free agent on a one-year contract is almost how he lives his life.
Wow.
And that person behaves differently with risk than someone who's got a very long-term outlook.
Yeah. Do you have time for one more phone call? Okay, let's go to Kurt. Thanks for waiting, Kurt. Hi. From Triple
Thank you. Sounds like a fascinating look back. And I mean that literally. This and many other books are exposés after the fact. I've been wondering the last couple of years, every time it is said that, you know, nobody saw this, everybody's surprised. I was a dairy farmer back in the 80s, 30 years ago, and we saw what was going on, the making of money with nothing underneath it. You can go back clear to the first democratic populist movement during the Golden Age after the Civil War. And the same thing was happening. It's more than a mere economic data question. It's theological, it's social, it's political, it's philosophical. Sometimes it's almost a metaphysical question of what is it that we value and how do we create wealth out of nothing as though we were God? Or does it require, you know, actual goods and real services of human beings and not just trading air and calling it wealth?
All right. That's a good final question or
that wasn't
comment.
A question. It was a statement. It was a very nice statement to end on.
Yes, it was. well, thank you so much. You are one heck of a writer. I've seen The Blind Side, but I haven't read your other work, and I don't understand this stuff at all, and I got a much better understanding of it, but I was just totally absorbed by the characters. They are characters.
Thanks for reading it.
Yeah, thanks very much, Michael, for being with us. Michael Lewis, author of The Big Short, Inside the Doomsday Machine.